Welcome to the Aquariumax Audio Show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 70, recorded July 12, 2011.
Greetings, everyone.
Hello.
We have lots of lovely stuff. We have so many contributors today. We've got some messages from David in Texas. We've got Anne in Pittsburgh. We've got Andreka. We've got Adrian. And we've got Mick. And maybe somebody else, but I think that's the balance of our contributors for today, as far as I can tell. So we are glad.
Nice range from all over.
Yeah, Adrian's in Vancouver and Mick's in Carnforth, and Andreka's in Oregon. So there we go. First of all, we're going to listen to David in Texas's messages to us. So here we go. To listen to his.
Hi, Russ and Kelly. We all sit any time of the day or night, so hopefully this won't wake anybody up. David Nolan, Harlingen, Texas. Appreciate some of the information. You know, you cover some of the things I'd asked about, I guess, in an email or a voice message. I find the voice message is a little bit easier. I hope that's all right. It's really neat to be able to share some ideas. And so let me see if I can be quick. The EcoBioRock, that's really neat. You know, it certainly is not at all attractive. It's a great idea, and that's the idea that I had, that I had talked with the people at SeaChem about using some of their biomatrix to make rocks like that. And the EcoBioRock on the website, they said it's made out of volcanic rock and cement. So I'm going to try to do some things that will more aesthetically, you know, look like actual rocks, like they make the live rock for saltwater or for freshwater. So I'll send some pictures if you all want. And experiment with that some. Also, I think it's great if you want to go longer on the show. No problem. I really enjoy your podcast a lot. So, and a compliment about that is it's really nice because y'all are just real natural. It's just like you're having a conversation. I really enjoy that, your style. Both of you, you know, talking, visiting back and forth, and then covering some of the questions. And I just really like your style. Let's see, I had, there was an article I had emailed about. I don't know if you got it, but it was David Berowitz. It's called The Time for a Change, A Mathematical Investigation of Water Changes, November 2009, Tropical Fish Hobbyist Magazine. And, boy, after I read that, it just changed everything for me. He did some specific testing to demonstrate that larger water changes are much more effective than smaller ones. You know, the traditional wisdom has been 10 or 20%. But if you want to go and take a look at that, it's, well, there's no question. I mean, he just shows how you change a little bit of the water, just dilutes the pollutants. But obviously when you change a lot of it, which I've been doing for a while anyway, 80, 90% water changes once a week. And I do let the water sit overnight. I have a barrel and then I also got a Rubbermaid stock tank. Let fill and let the water age and aerate. Anyway, okay, I got to be quick. Maybe I should. So, and also the down here where I live, it's hurricane season, and we always are worried about power going out. And this is, it's an investment, but for about $100, you can get the brand I got is Black & Decker Electromate 400. It's an AC/DC portable power supply. And you plug it in, and you can look it up on the internet. Black & Decker Electromate 400 AC/DC portable power supply. This is a really neat thing to have on hand. It'll power aquarium filters for a long time. I think the heaters would drain a lot quicker. But, you know, if you lose power, it's just a wonderful thing to have on hand. So there's my something to share with everybody who might be concerned about losing electrical power. And then another issue is using peroxide instead of Clorox for disinfectant. It's very safe and very effective, and some of the cities, city where I live, the health department has been recommending restaurants use peroxide instead of Clorox. So that tells you something, and peroxide is really, I mean, you know, it works great. It's not the concerns around aquariums that you have with Clorox. Quickly, okay, what else did I want to ask you about? The other thing, I've had great success using the compact fluorescent twist CFLs for aquarium plants. And it's real neat because now you can get them like the real affordable four pack of 100 watt equivalent for under $10, and 65K, 5000K, you know, they give you the ratings on the bulb, on the package. And I use the 65K and the 5000K with really good results. So, okay, that's enough, something else to share. Thank y'all. Thanks for being there. Thanks for letting us share. And take care. And my worms are doing great, too. The Grindle seem to be doing fine. I'm looking forward to getting those and Darrow worms. I think they're going to be reproducing, too. So thank you very much. Okay, bye.
So, okay. Yeah, thanks, David, for sending all those comments in there. Some great stuff in there. So let's see, you talked about the EcoBioRock and the C-Chem Biomatrix and how you're going to do some experiments with the maybe the C-Chem Biomatrix and making your own freshwater live rock.
And okay, and remind everybody, or at least refresh my memory, what is the EcoBioRock and the C-Chem Biomatrix?
Oh, okay.
You know, do you take a little blue pill and slide through a tube, or is this
a different kind of matrix?
Okay.
Yeah, the idea that David had mentioned in a previous message was that, you know, in salt water you have live rock that is porous and it has certain minerals in it, and it basically works as a very effective type of biofiltration because you get bacteria that live on the outside and on the inside that do different things, and so you can remove a lot of the waste or change them to other types of materials in the water. And he was wondering about doing that in freshwater. I mean, gravel does something sort of like that to some extent, but a porous material would work in a different way. And so we mentioned also on the show about EcoBioRocks, which are a brand of, it's a material that does basically that. And he mentioned also that he was wondering about doing that with the C-Chem Biomatrix materials that they have, and how we could make one. His idea is to make one that's aesthetically pleasing. The EcoBioRock, the basic idea is to make one that's functional. But he was thinking you could make one that's shaped like a rock, textured like a rock.
You gotta have function and style together.
Yeah. So he's looking into experimenting with that. Please do send pictures. That sounds cool. We'd like to hear about that. And he also mentioned that he likes our style. I thought that was cool.
Speaking of style.
Yeah. So
that was very nice of him to say, actually.
Yeah. Yes. We're glad you like that. And we hope the rest of you too do too. Most of you probably do. You wouldn't be listening. But that's good. So thank you. We do appreciate that. And then the article in Tropical Fish Hobbyist about the water changes. Yeah, I tried to go to that, and I couldn't get the link to work. Maybe I'm going through the wrong route or something. So if you can help us out with that, maybe there's something I'm doing or not doing that I need to be doing to be able to open that link out, because I would love to read that. And I do agree. You mentioned you do 80 to 90% water changes. I think since you do the aging overnight in containers and aeration, so you don't have to worry about outgassing, that's great.
So that's kind of the key to making that work there.
Yeah, you do need to make sure the water is outgassed, but that's what he's doing, so 80 to 90%, I mean, I can't imagine any fish.
So how does that work
maybe some
bigger tanks?
Uh-huh. You have to have a lot of water to change. Of course, usually in those cases, if you're doing that, you have a big pump hooked up to a hose, and so when you're ready to put the water back into the tank, you just flip on the pump and it pumps the water out of your reservoir into your tank.
So I was going to say, you can't really do that with the python.
No, you could drain it with the python, but
you couldn't fill it.
So you just, usually have a pretty strong pump, because that's a lot of head pressure, so you need a pretty strong pump down in your reservoir to get it up into a bigger tank. But yeah, that is the ideal way to do it. We also appreciated your ideas about the power supply. You know, David mentioned that it's hurricane season where he is, so he has to think about that a lot, about maybe losing power, and those uninterruptible power supplies that we often use, you know, for our computers, like that one down there, we have.
You can get those for your fish tank.
Well,
can you use like the same kind of thing that we have hooked up to our computers?
That's the idea. Yeah, that's what he was saying.
All-purpose generator-y kind of thing.
No, he's talking about one of those. It's got a battery backup. It charges by being plugged in, and then your computer runs through it, but it doesn't run off the battery until the power goes out. And it's the same thing. It's just get one of those and use it for your fish tank instead of computer. Now, most of them have warnings on it. Don't use around wet places or so on, but you're not going to get it wet, hopefully. You know, that's the idea. but I don't know if they have any specifically for aquariums. I don't think so. But
anybody out there who's in product development, there you go.
But the ones
that cost you a bone.
Yeah, but the ones that are sold for computers, you know, they work, and that's what Dave was talking about. So that's a good idea. I also liked his idea about hydrogen peroxide as a cleanser that you can use around aquariums much more safely than you could use bleach. Mm-hmm. That's a good way to go, I think. Of course, you still have to be careful with it to some extent, but not nearly as much. In fact, some people have used hydrogen peroxide as an algae control and actually add it to a tank with fish in it.
Really?
Yeah, you have to be careful about how you do that.
Wow.
And there are different ways that people do that. I wouldn't just
say... You just picture the fish, whoa, they just added a bunch of bubbles.
See, I think you'd have to be really careful.
All carbonated.
I think the safest way that people have done it is actually cause hydrogen peroxide to be naturally produced by adding barley straw, which as it decomposes in the water, releases very small measured amounts, not measured, but very small amounts of hydrogen peroxide that are against the algae.
Interesting.
I think the safest thing that people have done to control it is not add it directly to their fish tank, but actually they've put it in a bath. They'll take a plant out, like an Anubias plant that has algae on it,
and
put it in a bath that is a diluted
solution
of hydrogen peroxide and dip the leaves in there for a while. I think. It's been a while since I've researched that, but we do appreciate that, the hydrogen peroxide, because it is a lot safer than bleach, obviously. You take a teaspoon of hydrogen peroxide and put it in your tank, and you're a lot safer than if you put a teaspoon of
bleach
in there. So, I'm not advocating, particular quantities here. I'm just saying,
for
quantity
example,
per quantity, unit per unit, hydrogen peroxide is a lot safer. So, and if you're interested in hydrogen peroxide as an algae control or something like that, please look it up, because I don't remember specific quantities, and I wouldn't want you to do anything dangerous, of course. But, yeah, that's a good idea. And that the compact fluorescent bulbs, I use some compact fluorescent bulbs too. I have a couple of cheap lids, aquarium hoods from just stock lighting that you get for aquariums that have screw in for incandescence. And I put in compact fluorescents in there too. So I love them. I think they work great. And I'm glad that you're having success with them too, David. I would say, can you tell us brand names? I'd be excited to see which ones you use, because...
Of the CFLs?
Yeah, the ones that I get, I find them at a particular large box store, which I rarely go to by choice, but it's the only place I can find these particular ones that fit the sockets that I have, that also produce the right Kelvin rating of light, the color temperature. So I would like to know where you get yours or what brand you have found that work, that are the particular color temperature that you found, because that would be very helpful. The ones I have, I think, are 6500K, which are great, but as I said, I have to go to a particular box store that I have no particular desire to go to.
Have a particular desire to avoid, because we dislike it intensely.
So we only go there like once every 4 months or something.
Just to get the light bulbs.
So if you can tell us which brand you use, that'd be great, because I'd love that. Okay. Thank you, David.
Indeed. Let's move on to Anne in Pittsburgh.
Yes. She is the same Anne who emailed us about snail control a while ago, but we didn't know exactly where she was from, but she has since responded and told us that's where she's from Pittsburgh. So there we go. That's where she is. Anyway, and in episode 68, we talked to her about the snails and about how the fact that these pest snails that she has might also be eating fish eggs, so... she looked up physis snail as per our suggestion on the web, but she thinks that the ones that she have are probably brown ram's horn snails. And in fact, later on, she sent a photograph of these snails, and they are indeed ram's horn snails. So, good ID there. And she said that one website she found said that ram's horn snails are good for planted tank, as they don't eat plants, but her snails do. My experience with ram's horns is that sometimes they eat plants, sometimes they don't. There are several species of ram's horn that's out there. I don't know if that has anything to do with it.
You know what else they do?
What?
Sometimes they sneak up on you and say that we're about to have the break.
I've never heard a snail do that.
Oh, trust me.
I won't doubt your word on that. We'll just go ahead and have a break and appease the snails.
This isn't a commercial, because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful now, was it? Okay, I think snails are appeased now.
Okay. So as I was saying, I've seen some websites and articles maintain the same thing, that they don't eat plants, but my experience has been that sometimes they do. I might say that most of the time they don't eat healthy plants, but sometimes they do eat healthy plants. And they certainly aren't above eating plants that are not, you know, the leaves that are getting old and so on.
So they're kind of a wild card,
is
what you're
saying. Yeah, kind of a wild card. They can damage healthy plants, and they do so in some cases. So I would say, we will put this picture on the resources page so everybody can check it out and see the picture that Anne took of her snails. And she said that one of the local fish stores has offered to trade some assassin snails for some young endlers that she is breeding.
Sounds like a good trade.
Yeah, so when her fry get bigger and to a sellable size, she's thinking of getting those. And before that, she might try a lettuce trap, and those are good.
Tell us about the lettuce traps.
The one that she had read about uses a film canister with a piece of lettuce inside it overnight, and you just pull it out.
Did we do a podcast on traps?
We did, and you can use a fish trap just like that, mm-hmm. and put some lettuce in it. The fish trap that we did, the one made out of a water bottle. Yeah. You can do the same thing and put one in. Except if you have fish that are attracted to lettuce, then you might have a problem. But if you don't have fish that care about lettuce, then you can use that as well. And she was wondering about being able to find the assassin snails again, since the tank has a lot of plants and wood and rocks, which she also sent a photo, which we'll put on the resources page. But since the ram's horn snails would eat the fish eggs anyway, it seems I don't have much to lose, she said. And I would say the assassin snails are going to be easier to get rid of than the ram's horn snails.
Well, and she wouldn't really need to get rid of the assassin snails. That's part of what's so lovely about them.
Well, if she wants to keep the fish eggs, just in case they bother her killifish eggs, she might need to take them out. But my inclination, I don't know exactly how many snails you have in the tank, and I believe it's a 30-gallon tank, she said. If you just put one assassin snail in there and see how it does after a few months, I mean, it might not take a long time. If you have a lot of snails in there, you might need to put it there for a couple of months. But if you just have, you know, a couple of dozen maybe in the 30-gallon tank, put an assassin snail in there, it might just be a couple of weeks and they'll be all gone. And then you'll leave it in there for a while just in case the eggs need to hatch and grow up. No, mm-hmm. But it won't be too long, even if you just have one. But, you know, that would be a safe way. But assassin snails are out and about, especially when they're hungry.
All the time.
Yeah, they'll be out and about looking for food when they're hungry. So it'll be easier to find them, and their numbers will always stay smaller than ram's horn snails. So even if you had a couple of them stuck in there, you wouldn't need to worry about the eggs as much, because fewer of them would get eaten. You can also put a fish trap in there, a snail trap, and bait it with a meaty food like a crushed mussel. Get a frozen mussel from the seafood mm-hmm. section at the grocery store and throw that in there. You get the assassin snails on that. I feed mine frozen mussels. I'm usually the kind from the pet store, but
no frozen tendons.
Right. Sorry. So that could be a way to go. Oh, and she mentioned another thing about when we were talking about adding salt to Andreka's tank for ick on her cardinal tetras. Said when she did this, it did help cure the ick. It did it very well, but on two different occasions, she ended up accidentally killing her fish afterwards because right after she did a water change with fresh water, the change in salinity, she said, killed her fish within hours. And they
didn't have a chance to readjust to the salt being gone.
Yeah, and so one thing that Anne would like to say is just make sure that you're changing your salinity slowly, basically. So that it's not happening when you're adding it or taking it away. If you do it slowly, you won't stress the fish as much. And that's a good point, so thank you for bringing that up. Fish do vary greatly in their ability to tolerate salt and to adjust to salinities. So if you have sensitive fish, you need to be careful with that. And one thing is that salt, depending on the kind of salt you add and so on, it can also change the pH. And if you take salt out of a tank Changing pH quickly, let's just say it can be very stressful for fish. And so because certain types of salt can affect pH, you can be affecting pH greatly, quickly, by changing enough water to take out a lot of salt. And that can be a problem for fish too, and that could have been what stressed out the fish. So thank you for bringing that out. She also mentioned that she has put some of our suggestions from the podcast into practice.
Yay!
She's got a 3-gallon Eclipse tank. That's a tank with a bio wheel on it. A small, complete setup where the bio wheel is integrated into the lid of the aquarium. She said, after listening to our advice about the most important maintenance steps, she started just taking time to observe the tank, even when she was busy. And one day after redecorating the tank by adding more driftwood and plants, her filter kicked out. Stopped working. And the next day, she stopped and watched the tank and noticed all the shrimp at the top, like, gathered up.
So
like
we she had about noticed already like that. That her filter had kicked out.
Right. And she lifted the lid, and she said there was a bad sort of chloriney sulfury odor, maybe from the wood that she had newly placed in there. So she added a whisper filter that was too large for the tank, but just to get until the replacement filter came.
Mm-hmm.
And she put some carbon and ammonia absorbing resin in there in the filter, and almost instantly the shrimp relaxed and were active at the bottom again. She didn't lose anybody.
Yay! Well, good job!
So she was, you know, just taking that moment to look, and it made the difference for her. So good on ya. That's cool. I'm glad that worked out. And she said she also redecorated the tank with a carpet of Java moss for the substrate, which sounds cool. Please send us a picture of that if you've got one, or if you can get one. And she said she put narrow leaf Java ferns in too, and she got that idea from the Low Light Plants podcast. And she said the main reason she added those is because with a 3-gallon, ammonia and other parameters can fluctuate a lot very easily, which is true, because smaller tanks, you know, parameters are a little bit more wild. And we talked about plants being effective filters with that, so that can help keep things stabilized. She really likes how the Java moss looks in there, so I would love it if we would both love it if you'd send us a picture of that tank with this substrate in there. I bet that looks cool. I love carpet, you know, anything carpety in a tank. If it's Richa or if it's Java moss or Pelia or whatever it is, it looks cool. So that would be fun if you sent us about that. And let's see. I think we've just about covered everything in
from Anne's
contribution. Yep.
Okay, so let's visit Andreka.
Okay.
Our regular. Yay!
Yeah. Yeah, she said she's... fish seem to be holding up okay, but she's still got a very small trace of ammonia in there, so she's working on that. She's trying to get herself geared up to do more frequent water changes, and she was wondering about live rock for fresh water. So hopefully what we talked about with Dave will help with that. If you want to look at the eco bio block as one possibility, or just getting some lava rock, the kind that we get is the kind that's made for, what do you call it? Grills, barbecue grills. They're made to replace the lava rock that are used in many types of barbecue grills, and so you just get a bag of that, and they come in fairly large chunks that way instead of the really small pounded ones. In the garden section, it's really small and pounded, the ones we use for landscaping. And those are okay, too, but if you want a bigger piece...
Where do they have the barbecue kind? I don't remember where we got
near the outdoor area or the barbecue area of a store.
Barbecue area.
Yeah. Oh, they have those. They do. That's where I got it. And
I think you're making that up.
So you might want to look at that as a source of freshwater live rock. And you need to be careful because sometimes there are toxins in it. One thing that I
are
do...
Are they treated with
often
things?
Is I will soak it. I don't think they treat them, but I think they can potentially harbor minerals and things like that. What I usually do is soak it several times, kind of like you might do with driftwood.
Mm-hmm.
Soak it in water, dump the water, soak it in water, dump the water a few times. And then it's a good idea to put... some people do this. I usually don't do this, but some people put a fish in a container with it for 24 hours and see if it's awake alive the next day.
That seems kind of
callous, but... I've never had a problem with it, but I do usually do a soaking first several times to get it clean. So that could be an idea. She said she was listening to the Aquarium Mania podcast, and they were talking about Dr. Tim's nitrite or nitrate eaters. So what do you think of that product? Well, honestly, I haven't used it, and I told Andrake about this in an email. I haven't used it. I've heard good things about Dr. Tim's products. He's apparently pretty knowledgeable in his field and his science is good, but I haven't used any of his products. So what I would like to hear from any of you, if you've used Dr. Tim's products, what your experience has been. That would be helpful, because I haven't used any. And so I could give a better answer if I had some help, maybe from you all could help me with that. She also says that she's tried to find the wattage of the LED light we asked about on her MarineLine 29-gallon, but it's not in the manual, so she's going to have to figure out if she can find that out. And maybe she could call
them
or something.
The manual's online, probably? Or?
They might, but she has the manual. It's just not on there.
Oh,
the
okay.
Information's not on there, but you might have to call MarineLine or something like that. I'm actually thinking of putting a double bright LED strip on one of the tanks, but I'm kind of unhappy with the way that they're set up in a way, because right now they're double brights and they're single brights. They're new LEDs, like they're mid-range LEDs that they have. Are
this is MarineLine?
I think it's MarineLine, I'm pretty sure it is. They've got it set up so you can either have the tank on, you can have it on the nightlight setting, or you can have it off. But you have to manually switch it between nightlight and daylight. And I like to have all my tanks on timers, so I don't forget, because inevitably I would forget if I didn't do that. But I like the nightlight to be on. So I could put it on a timer and have it switch from daylight to off, or from nightlight to off by itself. But I would prefer it to do all of those settings, have them all on a timer. So I don't know, I may hold out until they do that. They should build an integrated timer, I think, but that's me. And then Andreka had another question about vacuuming in aquariums. Basically, she said that when she does the vacuuming, she notices the water is very dirty. She goes with the gravel with the vacuum, removes the big faux rock in there to do the vacuuming, and her boyfriend gets the vacuum running and leaves the rock in, and he doesn't get any of the dirt or the detritus out of the gravel, or not
very
much.
So the question is, how much of it do you want to take out?
Yeah, she says, thoughts do you have on different cleaning styles? And that actually ties in nicely with a question we have from Adrian. So we'll come back to that when we talk about his question, because they're close related.
Okay.
So we'll come back to that later. And she also said that she did a water change today, and she wanted to get the pH balance, and she did several water tests with nitrate, nitrite, and even ammonia, and the ammonia seemed fine, so that's good. It's coming down. But the pH went from 8 yesterday to 8.4 or something when she just did a water change. She said she used a little bit too much conditioner. Would that be a problem in the cause of my high pH? And I will look online to find a way to lower it, maybe vinegar. Any thoughts you have are appreciated. So the climbing pH actually could just be the water change. If I understand what happened correctly, your water was at 8, you did a water change, and then your pH was at 8.4. Sometimes it's just the water change, because if your water out of the tap may have some pressurized CO2 in it, which may bring it down a little bit, but once that outgasses, your pH will go up a little bit again, and then you have some buffer. If you have a high buffering capacity in the water, if this is the case that you have a high buffering capacity of the water, and you're adding that water to your tank, well, a tank...
Wait, back up.
Whoa, okay.
Tell us what high buffering capacity means.
Basically, high buffering
capacity... non-chemistry people.
...is the ability of the water to maintain alkalinity, maintain a high pH, I guess we could say. It has certain chemicals in the water that will keep... They'll sort of bind with the hydrogen molecules, so keeping the water on the alkaline side rather than the acidic side. But, I'm saying that wrong. Buffers tend to help water migrate towards the middle if they're mild buffers. But, no, I'm messing it all up. Okay.
I'm sorry.
I want to make it clear. Okay. Basically, buffering capacity tends to make water a little bit more alkaline, but buffers can also make highly alkaline water a little less alkaline. But in general, when we talk about buffering capacity, we're talking about how water can... the chemical nature will allow it to sort of prevent water from getting too acid. Okay. I'm trying to keep it not too technical and still make sense and still be accurate. And I'm making a mess of it. But here we go. So, in a tank... The biological processes occurring in the tank tend to make water more acid over time.
Okay.
Okay. The fish are producing wastes and so on that are making the water become more acid. Now, when you take out a quantity of water from that tank and you put in water from the tap that likely has some of these buffers in it, mm-hmm. what will sometimes happen is you have a fairly low pH to when you test before the water change, you
because
put this new water
acidic.
In. Right. And some of the buffering capacity has been reduced over time through all these biological processes. Mm-hmm. You put this new water in and the pH bounces back up because of the buffers in the new water and the dilution of the acidic water. Yes.
Okay.
So that may be what happens. Now, 8.4, that's pretty hard water.
Is that inherently bad or inherently good, or it just depends on...
It's not inherently bad. A lot of fish can survive just fine at pH that high. It's high. I'm not going to say it's not high. I mean, it's African cichlid high, African rift lake cichlid high. They'll be happy in that kind of water. It's pretty high pH water. There are lots of fish that can survive. A lot of normal pet fish that people keep can survive and even do well, health-wise, in water of a pH like that, but will not necessarily be able to breed in water like that. Like cardinal tetras are not going to breed in water like that. They might not show up their best colors, but they can survive. My take on pH, I have something adding things to water, to additives to water to reduce pH is usually not the most effective because of this buffering capacity and so on. You can add a few drops of vinegar to a tank. It can be dangerous to do, but I'm just saying it's possible to add a few drops of vinegar to a tank, and then you have the pH go down a bit. There are also substances like one called pH decreaser or pH down, different things like that. You can put those in the tank. They will sometimes reduce the pH for a little while until the buffering capacity has had a chance to chemically react with the acids in the water, and the pH goes back up. There are very few options when it comes to keeping the pH low in a tank, and I think the best one is to use RO water as part of your makeup water, your water changes.
So it doesn't have all these buffers in it?
Yeah, they've been removed. And so the water's chemically more pure, it's chemically lower on the pH scale, and it will keep your water softer and more acid in general. You can also filter your water through peat pellets or peat pucks, like hockey pucks. You can filter that. You add those to your filter. Mm-hmm. That they will actually do an ion exchange with the water and remove some of those calcium, magnesium ions from the water. That will do it. That's another way to do it. But other than failing one of those two methods, I really don't think it's usually a very productive thing to reduce the pH, because you want pH should be stable more than it should be ideal. There are a lot of fish that do well around 7.0, a lot of fish that do well around 7.5 and so on. 8.4 is a little high, but in general I find that fish respond better to a stable pH than they do to one that bounces up and down. And so if you're performing regular partial water changes, the pH will tend to be more stable and the fish will be happier, and I wouldn't even play with the other stuff. I think your fish will be fine. You may not get any cardinal tetras to breed, but I don't think that's your goal right now, so I don't think you have to worry about that. And if you do want to set up an Amazon biotope or something like that, then you'll definitely want to look into getting a reverse osmosis unit for RO water in the future. But other than that, I would say, don't even need to worry about it much. Then, all right. She also included some pictures of her betta caches, and I love that name. That's a reference, of course, to Muhammad Ali, it's got to be, because that's his real name.
Was it really?
The boxer, Cassius Clay, I think it was.
I didn't know that.
And so, because it's a...
He floats like a betta?
Yeah, and stings like a bumblebee.
Jellyfish.
I don't know. Okay, so that's a cool name for a betta then, because, he's a boxer and everything, so that's cool. I like that. She said that he had fin rot after he didn't get a water change for a while, and
uh-oh.
But now he's doing better, although his fins are a bit shorter. She said she had great difficulty in getting her camera to take a clear pic of a fish, and then the fish to stay visible for the duration of the photo. Any pointers? So I've got a few basic ones. I'm not a great fish photographer myself, but I have learned a few things that can help. One is to take high-angle shots. So if
now, does that mean you're up above the thing you're photographing, or you're looking up at them so you're below them?
Camera is up above, and you're aiming down towards the fish. Okay. Because it keeps the glare down, and you can use a flash, and the flash won't bounce off the glass at you. Mm-hmm. And the flash does help to keep the image sharper, but it also will bounce off the glass if you aim directly at the glass, and then you get a flash in the middle of the picture, and the glare makes the picture look stupid and ruins it. So, yeah, the high-angle shots help. I also use the macro setting. Probably you would have, you know, I'm sure you thought about that already, but the macro setting can help a lot sometimes. If you have a rapid fire setting where you can just hold down the shutter and just takes pictures like that, that's a good idea.
That was a pretty good sound effect.
Thank you. I like to make sound effects. And then take like 30 or more shots and expect to get one half decent shot out of it if you're lucky.
This is why we like digital cameras. Yes. You don't have to waste all your film.
For all the, you know, for one half-decent shot that I take, I take a billion crummy ones. So that's how it works with fish. So hopefully that, you know, those are really basic hints, but they've helped me get some half-decent shots once in a while.
Might just help to keep the camera right next to the fish tank, too, because if you're looking at it and you think, oh, I could get a shot, by the time you get the camera, they're gone, they're moved, they're hiding, whatever, you know.
Yeah. Something I also do is take high-definition video of the fish and then just crop a picture out of there. If you have some sort of application that allows you to do that, then that can sometimes work too. And then she said, here's the last thing. She said she listens to the Aquariomania show too, and she said the people in the show are sharp, intelligent, articulate, some of the best public speaking interviews ever, and she listens a lot to it. She said, what is it about fish people? I wonder what they eat, their vitamins, their work environment, they just seem so clear thinking. Well, I hope that's true. I would say one thing though. I think I sound very clear thinking a lot of the time on the show, but I do think fish bring an element of profound tranquility to an otherwise hectic life.
That's true.
What do you think?
Yep.
There you go. So maybe I need more fish and then I will sound more articulate on the...
started breeding goldfish in the first place, wasn't it?
Oh, probably.
Because they're so peaceful.
Yeah, they're so zen. Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so thank you, Andreka.
Okay, we are moving on to Mick in Carnforth. Hello, Mick!
And by the way, Mick, if I slaughter the pronunciation of that word, feel free to help me out, because I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so he said that he thought he would let us know that the fire-belly toads are doing well with the newts, and one likes to swim several times a day, while the other is more sedentary and likes to sit in the large fern near the back of the tank. Feeds them on small crickets every 4 days, which he dusts with a multivitamin and calcium powder. And they really go for the crickets, so he has to be careful not to overfeed them because they are prone to obesity. And then he was also looking at an article online about African dwarf frogs, which reported good success with feeding Tetra Pro crisps. I love this because...
These are like, what, professional potato chips? Pro crisps?
No. They're kind of little teeny wafers of fish food. And I like this idea. I'm going to try this, because I can get those. And they sound to me like they're probably more nutritious and palatable than most of the pellets that are sold for African dwarf frogs.
You haven't really been very happy with
those. Yeah, most of the brands that I find are based on wheat. Now, do frogs eat wheat?
Frogs don't eat wheat. It's like dog food. Why is the first ingredient in dog food always wheat or corn?
Yeah, it's because it's a cheap filler. That's why it's in these things.
It's the same reason why people food is so bad for us.
So I would like to look more into these ProCrisps. I think I've used them before, but it's been a long time, so I need to try again. And he says he uses this already as a staple for his breeding tanks for his fish. Mm. So he might as well give it a try, and his frogs love it. And he gives it to them two or three times a week, and he uses his frog pellets, which are a different brand than I use, so I want to try those too. Some live mosquito larvae from his outdoor water tub and frozen brine shrimp, and they're doing well. And he says three of the five are looking wider and slightly bulkier than the other two, and he's thinking they may be female, so
that would
be cool to see. Yeah, and I love the outdoor water tub thing. I've got a couple of Daphnia tubs outside, three of them actually, one with very tiny species of Daphnia and a couple with the big ones. And it's so nice to go out there and swish a brine shrimp net around in there a few times and come up with a bumper crop of Daphnia and feed the fish. And the fish love it, of course. So, lovely things, outdoor water tubs when the weather permits. He also had a kind of a funny story about his humpback lemia. And a lemia is a type of live bearer. It's not one of the big four that people normally find.
Does it look like a lima bean?
Not really. But they have a much more deep body than most live bearers do. In terms from if the fish is swimming in its normal orientation, from the top of its back down towards its belly, it's deeper that way than some of the other live bearers, you think, much deeper than a guppy anyway. And he said he's got this humpback lemia that has been in a 3-foot tank with his Pelvic Acromus tayonatus, which are a close relative of the crebensis. And he has... They were having fighting in his breeding tank with his lemias, and so he put them in with the Pelvic Acromus, and he has been trying to mate with the female Pelvic Acromus.
It's a little bit confused.
Yeah, following her around and flicking his gonopodium.
Either that or he's just desperate.
He's a bit forward, yeah.
Those live bearers, I don't know.
Yeah, but live bearers are like that, it's true. And he thought after a few days he would get the message, but he's been so persistent that he just removed him back to the breeding tank with the other lemias, and now he's doing fine.
Maybe his other fish should get a restraining order.
Yeah, that sounds like he's a very frustrated lemia. So I'm sure he's glad to be back with his own kind. And he has a comment about how he built his beach for his paludarium with the plant cell trays, the gravel, and the moss. And he could put it together a few photos, 3 or 4 of them, and show the process. I would love to see that. That would be very nice. So we'd be happy to see those pictures. Please send those. And he said, I have really enjoyed the last few shows, and it is great to have so many people sending things in to you. Well, me too.
Yay!
It is really nice to have a lot of different people writing in, and a lot of variety and questions. So please keep that up, too. And all of you, please keep it up. Now let's go on to our last contributor.
Adrian.
Yeah, Adrian is our first...
I was just going to say our first Canadian contributor,
I think,
yes?
So, yeah. I'm pretty sure. So that's cool. We're glad to have a Canadian contributor, too. So, he said he's been joining our show for quite a while. Keep up the good work. I hope it pays well enough.
Pays? What are you talking about?
We wish.
Pay anything.
I'll keep my day job in the meantime. But... said he has a suggestion for a show topic, and of course he has that because it would help him out. He's in the process of setting up a large tank, 120 gallons, and wondering what type of tips...
Do Canadians have little... I mean, do they have different gallons?
Oh, because he says 120 of your little gallons.
Little gallons.
Is there a different type of gallon? I am displaying my ignorance about that.
Not on the metric system in Canada?
U.S. gallons are different from the ones in Britain, I think, so maybe they're different in Canada, too.
They use liters in...
Maybe you can maybe fill Mick us in on that, Adrian, how that works.
And or Stuart and or Adrian can
tell us how that
fill
works.
Fill in the gaps of our international measuring knowledge.
Yeah. And his basic idea is, what do people do to keep an aquarium this size in a happy condition? And he recently renovated his house and had the floor reinforced to support the weight, which is good because that's something
excellent
to think about when you have a tank that big. But his concerns are more about how to run the tank. Like, he can't see himself doing many 20% water changes on a tank this large, or it would be really hard to store aged water in any quantity that would be functional without a lot of effort. And he doesn't have a convenient tap that I could attach a python to, he says, unless he runs a hose into the house from the outside, and the kitchen faucet is one of those spray types, so there's no threaded nozzle.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bit of a sticky wicket, as Kelly's dad would say.
He likes to say that.
He loves that phrase. This is a bit of a problem, and I would say that this sounds like it could be a really cool setup. He's thinking of putting a few large schools of small fish in, some angelfish or gouramis, keeping the bioload on the light side, good idea, keeping the tank heavily planted.
Also a good idea.
He's going to be in the living room, so he said his wife will insist that it's good looking, and the plant should keep the tank looking fresh and alive, and the fish will provide splashes of color and some action to watch. Now, I like that. All sounds good. But the one problem with these water changes, that's going to be a pretty big issue, I think. And it's true that a larger tank is more stable than a small one. It's true that a heavily planted tank with a light bioload will help maintain water quality. But I think you'll ultimately be happier with the tank if you figure out a way to keep up these water changes because, well, for a lot of reasons. Of course, water changes just help with algae, for example. A heavily planted tank that doesn't get frequent water changes, pretty soon some form of algae is going to take advantage of that. The fish aren't going to be as happy either. And so one thing you can try with the python on this sink is a universal clamp connector, which is a rubber with a metal clamp that you screw on, and it'll attach to almost anything. So you might want to look into that. Another thing, if that doesn't work, I would seriously look into replacing the sink, the faucet, the tap itself. I would look into replacing that because it's going to make your life so much easier if you do.
I'm going to say just from the wife perspective, though, those ones that pull out and spray are so nice. It'd be so sad to get rid of it if there's another way that he can come up with.
You can get a side-mounted one. You can get the side-mounted kind. The little pull-out and spray thing on the, that are side-mounted like we used to have.
Do you have a normal faucet and a pull-out and spray one?
Yeah.
That would be fine.
No, yeah, it could work. Because it's... I just can't see long-term success without being able to do your water changes regularly, so something. Another possibility you can look into, I mean, think of this. This tank is going to be a big investment, really, right? I mean, monetarily.
That's a big tank.
120 gallons. To get that and the stand and all the equipment and the decor and everything is going to be expensive anyway. So if you're looking at it as this investment, I would say invest in something that's going to make water changes feasible, too. Because otherwise you're going to end up, you know, being...
Hating it.
Yeah, hating it. I guess that's a good way to say it. You can look into automatic water changing. You could plumb something, maybe, near the tank. It might be worth it. Set something up so that if you Google automatic water changes aquariums, people have some ingenious ways of doing this nowadays, where they just have something hooked up to the filter or a sump that automatically changes the quantity of the water every day. It's awesome. Or you can just flick a button and boom, it
and
will do
like
a water change.
It's like flushing the toilet. It just flushes the tank.
Yeah. So maybe look into something like that. I mean, it'll be a little more work and it'll cost a little bit more, but ultimately you'll be happier with it. So I would say...
It's assuming, of course, that you're going to stay in the house that you're in for a while, but since you just renovated, you probably are.
Yes. So that's true. And this also relates back to Andreka's question about vacuuming. Okay. Now, vacuuming the entire substrate with a python in a tank that big can be a pain. And in some sorts of tanks, you need to do it. You have a big bunch of messy cichlids or you got some arowanas in there or something. You'll need to do that anyway. And there's no way around it unless you don't have substrate and you have a big filter that sucks up everything. And then you just make sure you change the filter media a lot. That could help. But in a heavily planted tank, the nice thing about... There are really two ways you can go with substrate. Two main ways you can go with substrate. One is, if you're going to have substrate at all, you have the substrate such that you are going to be vacuuming it a lot and pulling as much detritus as you can out of it. Like you would in a tank with, you know, some boisterous goldfish or some cichlids that are going to be digging around in the gravel and making a mess if you don't. So you need to keep that out of there. You keep it out of the gravel. Okay? That's a good, effective way to do it in a tank where you just have gravel, you don't have a lot of plants growing in it, or you don't have any plants growing in it. Another method is to not mess with the gravel much, and don't try to pull detritus out of the gravel. Just leave the gravel alone. And this is usually with a planted tank with enriched gravel. It's not really gravel, it's more like, you know, something like fluorite, or gravel with a layer of laterite, or even gravel with a layer of garden soil under it or something like that, where you let the detritus build up and the lower level of oxygen there will allow different types of bacteria to exist there, and a lot of fancy chemistry goes on down there and a lot of nutrients are released in the substrate where the plant roots can get at them. Okay, if you do that, that's a great thing for heavily planted tanks. There are certain risks with a substrate like that with low oxygen. You can get pockets of hydrogen sulfide and things like that. But with a heavily planted tank, especially if you have things like, you know, Malaysian trumpet snails to dig around in there a little bit and so on, that help turn the substrate like earthworms do, this can help avoid that. But in generally, with a heavily planted tank, if the plants are healthy and growing quickly, the substrate can be like that, and then you don't really mess with it with the gravel. You might lightly vacuum over the surface of it to get any loose detritus, but you don't really have to worry about anything else. You don't have to try to pull that detritus out because the plants are actually converting the detritus to plant biomass, and then when you trim the plants, you're removing that waste. And so if in a heavily planted tank, you could keep the substrate relatively untouched and remove the loose detritus when needed. But the water itself will still need to be changed. So maybe look into an automatic system. It really might be a way to do it. So, like I said, if you Google automatic water change in aquarium, you'll get some good stuff to come up. So, see how that goes. It sounds like your water conditions are quite good for a number of fish. It's close to neutral pH and fairly soft, so... You know, gouramis and angelfish would do well in that water, and several tetras and so on. Although if you're getting small tetras and angelfish, eventually will come the day when the angelfish have some delicious snacks and you lose your tetras. So make sure that they're deep-bodied schooling fish, you know, something that angelfish are not likely to go after as much, because they will go after, you know, neons and things like that really easily. Of course, I'm sure you know that. And then you said the tank will be in the middle of the house. It won't be subject to wild temperature fluctuations from the sun hitting it, and so on, but you're guessing that the heaters are probably still necessary because the tank will want to be warmer than an average room temperature of about 68 Fahrenheit or so.
Ooh, 68 is too cold for people for room temperature.
Well, it depends on the person, but that was definitely too cold for angelfish to be happy. And
it must be an angelfish.
There are a few tetras which can handle that, but most tetras that you find in the pet stores not be happy with that, and most gouramis either. Paradise fish would be okay with that, but... Most gouramis would not be okay with that. So I would say, yes, you will need heaters for sure if you're planning on getting those kinds of fish. So hopefully this helps. Thank you, Adrian. Thank you, Andreka. Thank you, Mick. Thank you, David. And thank you, Anne, for your contributions today. And remember, if something fishy is not going on at your house, well, you better fix it. See you next time. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.